I would like to say a few more things.
No, please do.
Like, why did the balls detach?
Hello and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. In this episode, we are going to be discussing the first three episodes of Damon Lindelof's HBO series Watchmen. We are recording this right before the fourth episode. It may be out before the fourth episode is out. Otherwise, it'll come out after the fourth episode, which will be slightly strange, but this is the best time for recording for us. My name is F.T. Ward. I am Thomas on the podcast of Ice and Fire Forms. And today I'm joined by...
Hey everyone, Bina 007 on the forums.
Hey, Blue Armor on the forums.
Hey, it's Michael Mordian on the forums.
This is Adam, and my superhero name is Drone Snow.
I thought we would start off just giving our basic thoughts, maybe our history with the Watchmen comic and or movie, and then our basic thoughts on the series so far, as well as the Mooncake rating for what we've seen so far. So, Bina, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll give this a 5. I think taking it on its own terms, not being overly hung up about how Watchmen it is in terms of the Alan Moore novel, I'm really intrigued by it. I think episode 4 is going to be really fascinating because we're going to see Lady True. I want to see it. To me, it's like Westworld. It's tricksy. It's complicated. You can theorize about it. It's just exactly the kind of thing that suckers me in. And I love that it's tackling the race issue head on. I think that's brave and bold. And I can't wait to see where it goes.
I pretty much agree. I would class it as a 5. I expect I will feel the same at the end of the 9 episodes. I really like this series, and just kind of on a general like writing between the dialogue, the intricately woven plot, and like the real attention to detail of backstory and world building involving like kind of the source material in their own, it makes Game of Thrones look like it was written by a fifth grader.
I had to unmute my laugh for that part.
Well, maybe just two men who were high had no previous experience and didn't really know how to tackle a complex world.
Right, yeah, but part of it comes down to, you know, then if they can't do that, hiring people who can, and like just the team in the writer's room that Lindelof has like assembled, as well as kind of like working with closely with directors the way he does. Just kind of the crew he's assembled around himself has just really like shown what a talented bunch of people they are, and has really kind of elevated this series so far for me.
What about you, Michael? What would you give the series in Mooncakes and general thoughts?
I'm a little bit torn. So I would say, as far as like my enjoyment of it so far, I would say probably about a 4.5 along those lines. I agree with Bina. It reminds me of Westworld in the sense that I'm, you know, trying to, you know, figure out what happens. And I don't know, it feels kind of Westworldy to me, and I'm really enjoying it. I am also very skeptical that I will feel the same way at the end of the first season. Is it just one season? I don't know. Do people know?
I don't think we know for certain. Am I wrong about that?
Damon Lindelof has said
there have been conflicting
that
comments.
He only wants one season. Like, he thinks it should be a self-contained story insofar as Watchmen.
That would make me feel a lot better.
Apparently, he said that he got together with his writer's room and they said, what about the original graphic novel makes it Watchmen? And one of the things was the ability to have the confidence to make it a closed story, but with an ambiguous ending. And he is hoping to achieve that with this season, that it should stand on its own as a closed story, but also maybe not be entirely resolved. So he has said that HBO is comfortable with this. Now, if it's a huge success, it makes a ton of money. We'll see. But that is his intention.
Okay, that does make me feel better.
Didn't he also say, though, like, we wouldn't see certain characters in season 1, like implying that we'd see them in season 2?
I've heard that as well. But as I say, I think it's... I had not heard it as in strong terms as Bina put out, but I hope what Bina is saying is true. But I have my.
I would say where my source is the Hollywood Reporter has. Yeah, the Hollywood Reporter has a podcast series called TV's Top 5, and in each episode they interview a showrunner. So if you're into this, I would really recommend the Damon Lindelof interview, because it was done before the show airs, so there's no spoilers, but it's really interesting about how he approached the material, filling in the gaps between where the book ended and the show begins, and it just gave me a lot of faith in him. Like, I didn't watch Lost. I have a lot of friends who were burned very heavily by Lost.
Yeah.
So I was really nervous for Watchmen, but I just listened to this interview and I was just so impressed by how articulate, and it was also in that same week when D&D were just being dickheads about Game of Thrones, so the contrast was huge. So I'm sure there are commercial forces, and I think maybe you can interpret it as this is a story in the Watchmen universe, and you could see a season two being a different city character in the Watchmen universe, maybe, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'll put the link for that.
Yeah, in the HBO podcast, I think he said he wanted one season as well.
I guess I should ask people their history with Lindelof as well, maybe as important as their history with Watchmen. And
so far, I give it a 5 out of 5. Like, I'm really enjoying it, but it's all contingent on how it lands. Like, Lindelof is great at building a world. He's really good at it. He gets great people around him to help. But, how does this end?
What's your Mooncake rating, though, Thomas?
Yeah, I guess I would. I guess my apprehension level is slightly higher than everyone else's, so I would give it something like 4, just because I'm very apprehensive on how it's all going to come together. Go ahead, man.
I agree with that. I hadn't quite gotten there, but I was going to say my apprehension level is very high. Like, if I take into account my apprehension level, I would say it's a much more like a 3 than a 4.5.
Yeah, maybe I need to adjust my meds, but my anxiety is super high that things aren't going to work out. But I am enjoying it overall. I enjoy it the day after. I really find myself thinking about the world. It's much denser, and I mean that as a compliment, than I anticipated someone making a television show, because the graphic novel upon which it's based is extremely dense. And so I find Lindelof's comments and his reverence for the source material to be heartening, but I also have fears that at the end of this, I'm not going to be happy about it.
A question to you and Mordian, I guess, why are you scared? Is it because you love the material so much, or is it specifically related to Damon Lindelof and previous experiences with him?
I don't think I have any experience with him other than tangentially. I did not watch The Leftovers. I did not watch Lost. I guess maybe Westworld, a lot of people said it reminds them of Westworld quite a bit, and I found myself feeling like Westworld did not deliver completely on the promise of its premise, and certainly other people can disagree with that, but I hope it's a single contained story, but I have my doubts that that's the way corporations work.
I mean, I agree with your assessment on Westworld. I just don't necessarily...
Not entirely fair on my part to
yeah, like that would be my main argument, where so far over these first 3 episodes, I feel like they have a much better grasp on where they're going than the first season of Westworld did.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I feel I do have a little bit of Lindelof history, I guess. I mean, I watched a couple of seasons of Lost before being like, oh my god, this is... I mean, whatever, I'm not going to do a rant about Lost, but so that I definitely, when I looked up, I forgot who Lindelof was, and when I looked him up after I started watching Watchmen, I was like, oh no. But also, I have the same thing as far as Westworld. Like, as I said before, it does remind me of Westworld, and it's not fair, I suppose, to hang, you know, some issues I have with Westworld onto this, but I don't know, it really does feel similar to me. I don't know. I mean, the fact that in some ways I'm not really sure how to source my worry and trepidation, but I am just like, every episode I go into it with, it's like, is this where it becomes really stupid? And I am expecting that every time I turn it on.
I want to give you all a hug. Enjoy it totally, dude. Enjoy it totally. Just be thankful. But you've had another hour of TV.
Yeah. Well, my fear is more towards the end. I wish it were that easy. I wish I could turn things off.
I mean, I wasn't even planning on watching it. Like, I was a big fan of the movie and the graphic novel, and I was not planning on watching the show. I was just hanging out with some friends, and they were like, oh, do you want to watch the first episode of Watchmen? And I was like, I mean, I guess I can sit through it. It's fine. And I watched the first episode, and I was like, oh, I really like that. Like, I'm pretty into this, but, like, I don't know. Something's going to go wrong.
Should we do our experience of the material?
Sure, please.
I can go first. So basically, I didn't read them. Read the graphic novel as it came out, as I think David H.H.H. did. I read it in my 20s when I discovered Alan Moore. So I read that From Hell, loved it, and was very excited about the movie. Maybe liked it more than I think critical commentary would have done, but was very excited about this TV show. I don't have any Lindelof background, so I come at this very neutrally. I don't bring any baggage to it. But I just think Watchmen and From Hell, to me, are just like, to me, that's like Tolkien, Lord of the Rings. It's just War and Peace. Also, they're just at the top of their game, right, as documents. So it's going to be hard for anything to match up for that. And I admire anyone who tries in earnest good intentions, which is what I think Damon Lindelof is doing.
Yeah, I can't remember. I feel like I had a name, or some people on the forums had a name for a derogatory name for people who watched Game of Thrones before they read Song of Ice and Fire. And that's
show
what
watchers?
I am.
Is it
show? No, not that. It was something. Oh. Maybe I'm wrong. I feel like that there was something. Anyway, whatever. Maybe it was a private name that I had. But no, I watched the movie first. I watched the movie and really, really, really liked the movie a lot, and immediately went out and got the graphic novel and liked it probably more, I suppose. I mean, it's definitely denser, as people have mentioned, and it started me on an Alan Moore kick, and Alan Moore is absolutely incredible. I love all of his stuff that I've read.
I can give you a few things you won't like, I think.
Does that include the killing joke?
I don't care for the killing joke. I think there's artistry in the killing joke, but I'm not a fan of the premise, but go ahead. I don't mean that.
I haven't read like his like runs in comic books, because I'm not really a comic book person. I've read like his graphic novel stuff, like From Hell and V for Vendetta and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Watchmen and stuff like that. But I haven't read his runs in bigger comic book stuff.
I read it was slightly before the movie, sometime when I was in high school, college. I don't really remember. But yeah, no, I enjoy both, and similar to being probably I enjoy the movie probably more than most. I can see the problems with it, but Jackie Earle is Rorschach was so pitch perfect that I love it no matter what.
Yeah, I'll just say I read the graphic novel. Like, I got it at a Barnes & Noble after hearing a whole bunch of stuff, probably early 2000s. It was like about a year before the movie came out, I want to say. The Zack Snyder film. It just had a trade show I was going to, so I picked it up as just something to watch on the plane, and I really, really enjoyed it, and was super psyched to, you know, to see the movie and everything, which is a whole other issue. But yeah, I mean, I came to it, I guess, kind of late in that sense.
Yeah, I was reading comics in 1986, but not religiously, so I did not read it at the time. Again, don't remember when I read it the first time. It would have been probably college, late 80s. Watchmen itself, the graphic novel, is on, I don't know if this is still holds, but Time Magazine's list of the 100 best English language novels of the 20th century or something like that. I forget what the actual name of the list was, but it's highly influential, highly important. And I think it holds up on every level as a work of art and as a specifically comic sequential art, if that makes sense. I have issues with trying to adapt it to other forms. I also like Zack Snyder's 2009 film, but I think it lacks a little spark. It's a little trying to ape the source material too much, but I think it loses some magic somehow. There's just a spark that isn't there for me, even though I enjoy it quite a bit. Well, I'll just start with the beginning of the pilot, the setting of Tulsa, Oklahoma, which I think is interesting and has a very, for me, un-Watchmen feel to be in middle America the show opens with, and I think this is insidious language, but the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. To call it a race riot, I think, is loaded language, and it's probably technically accurate, but it's probably deceptive to call it that. It's a really interesting way to start this series. We see this from the perspective of a character who will be played by Louis Gossett Jr. In the present day. He is a child at this time, but I'd be interested in what you guys think of the setting of Tulsa, and then specifically beginning with 1921 Tulsa, how you feel that. It's really a powerful beginning, and I'm curious what other people's thoughts are on that.
I really liked it. I feel that original Watchmen tackled the dominant era of its time, which was the risk of a go-nuclear Cold War, what it felt to live under that threat. And I feel that, I don't know, this is maybe contentious, but the idea of divisions in society and racial divisions feels very contemporary and bold. And so I really like it. I like that you get the flashbacks. I thought it was really sensitively and well done, very powerful. It's not something I'd ever heard of before. And insofar as it causes everyone who's never heard of it just to read about it, that's already doing great service, regardless of the entertainment value.
I guess I agree. Unfortunately, race seems, at least in America, race issues are always contemporary, unfortunately. It's something that we're always dealing with, so I'm less certain that race is the predominant global issue the way that nuclear annihilation and the Cold War were in 1985. I think you talk about disparities, but I think not just race. There's the disparity of power between governments and corporations and everyone else, I think, is... So I'm hopeful that we're going there still, but I am glad for the race issue to be raised, and I think the Tulsa stuff is interesting and important, but I'm not sure for me, and like I said, we may still be going there. I think with Lady True and Adrian Veidt, we might still be going to Hulk and the Pedopedia material, the corporations and the government and their control and dominance is the central issue of the early 21st century.
I don't know. I mean, whether or not you can consider it the predominant global issue of the day, I like the ambition of tackling such a sensitive topic.
Sure, and that's, I think, a good use of the Watchmen title and legacy to kind of deal with important social and political issues, I think, is a relevant part in, like, I think someone had mentioned in when Damon Lindelof and the writers kind of got into a room and started discussing what makes something Watchmen. I think that's definitely appropriate for this material. The first contemporary scene in the Watchmen, again, is a really interesting traffic stop, flipping our expectations, maybe, with an African-American police officer and a white person. I would say redneck or anything, but a white person. And a traffic stop, and how that plays out, and how Lindelof and the writers introduce the differences between the world now. So the world in 1921 is our exact world, but our world and the Watchmen world are going to diverge somewhere in the late 1930s. So the current day, and I guess I should say the Watchmen series on HBO is a direct sequel to the world of the graphic novel and not the movie. They're very close to each other, but there's a slight differences there. So I'll just say that much. And then Lindelof, very slyly, I think, kind of electric cars, kind of the redneck, has a 50 star flag on his hat, as opposed to the current 51 state flag, with Vietnam becoming America's 51st state after the events of Dr. Manhattan winning the Vietnam War and Richard Nixon being reelected for multiple terms up until I think 1988, somewhere. He must have left office, either died or something, because Gerald Ford is president for some short time before, in 1992, Robert Redford becomes America's president. I'm trying to get, like, plot points across, but maybe it'd be better off if we just talked about the world a little bit that we were introduced to.
I mean, I did like that opening scene as sort of, and you touched on some of them, but like there were a lot of like relatively small details. I mean, obviously like the sort of inversion of what you might expect with the race swap of the black cop and the white, I don't know what you call them, guy that got pulled over. But yeah, a lot of things like, you know, just like guns being locked, the mask, like just a lot of little things where it's, I mean, you know, arguably little, I suppose, just a lot of little things that sort of show like different ways, because, you know, like the mask, obviously masked police officers, you know, would tend towards a view of the police that is much more like, you know, authoritarian-y, fascist-y, or whatever, if I can, you know, just throw around the word fascist without any real meaning behind it, colloquially fascist. You know, like a much more, you know, sort of conservative, scary sort of police department. And then that's immediately contrasted with the fact that they can't just carry and draw their weapons at will, that their guns are locked in the car and that they have to call back to have them unlocked. And so, yeah, just a lot of like just like little things in that very first contemporary scene, as you said, that help to give you a different, and not inconsistent in a bad way, but show you different things about the world that all pushed you in like in different directions about how you feel about it. Like, oh, this is good. That's nice. That's better. Oh, this seems weird and bad. You know, that kind of thing.
We are going to see very early on in that first episode the police behaving in a way that I think most of us would not want the police to behave. Certain things like when Angela Abar, we'll get to it, Sister Knight, basically kidnaps a guy, breaks into his house without warrant or any justifiable cause, brings him to the police station where he is then put in a pod and interviewed. And when he asks for his attorney, he says, Looking Glass says to him, we don't really have to do that for terrorists. And then they basically torture him for information at that point. So I think we see the police. It's very interesting because it's clearly white supremacists are the bad guys and there's no real ambiguity there, but the police are behaving in ways that I think most of us would not be comfortable with police behaving. So it's a very interesting dynamic they set up really right away there. The contrast and inconsistencies that we see with masked police, sometimes even plainclothes police, are basically masked vigilantes. And that's really, I think, an uncomfortable place to be headed for society. But those are my thoughts on it anyway.
Is there, I guess I didn't notice, and maybe it's not really in the world building or anything at this stage, but I was sort of thinking, like, I mean, in terms of, just because, I mean, the fact that they have their guns locked is like it's a pretty powerful thing, especially in gun heavy America. It's such a big nod towards like some sort of police accountability. Like, I was trying to figure out like how big a deal like the masks actually are in terms, like, I mean, like, I assume cops have, if not name badges, like maybe numbers or something, like some sort of like, you know, uniform ID number, so that people can call in, you know, complaints or, you know, and have some sort of like procedure for addressing police abuses or things like that, given that everyone obviously looks the same. The other thing, and I guess this is just me nitpicking, which is one of my favorite things to do, I don't really know how effective the mask thing is. Obviously, the what they're called, 7th Cavalry, they got all these cops like names and home addresses, right? Which are not publicly available anyway, right? Like, somebody stole those from some sort of database. It's not like the 7th Cavalry went around for months taking photographs of every police officer and then somehow matched their faces to like where they live, you know, like the whole mask thing just seems sort of like bullshit anyway.
Yeah, I don't even know if there are databases in this world, which is an interesting.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
But,
yep.
Good point. Yeah, it seems that there were at least someone on the inside to get the information of names and addresses. And it might have just been a cleaning person or something, but
sure, I mean, it could be anything, yeah. But yeah, it's still like that stuff's not publicly available, and it doesn't seem like it's not the fact that people could see your face when you pulled them over that told them like where you lived, you know? Like, so it's such like a, I mean, I suppose it's a very, I was going to say American, a very human reaction to do something completely, not completely unrelated to the problem, but something only tangentially related to the problem that wouldn't actually stop it from happening in the future.
Well said. Yeah, I guess we don't really for certain know what the gun situation is, other than I think there are references to them having guns grandfathered in, and then there's protesters with signs like, "We want our guns back."
With Yeah. And it wasn't clear to me either. Certainly with the liberal Redford government, in power for the last whatever it is, almost like 30 years, I guess. Yeah. Obviously, certainly possible that it is that's a national issue. But I mean, some things like the masks for the police seem to be local, and so I wasn't sure, if that had been, a state or a local thing. That's all okay.
No, I think the masks are dope. I don't know that we know yet whether the locking of sidearms for the police.
Yeah.
And Angela seems to hide her guns, though that may be just so there's guns throughout her house in case there is a home invasion or something like that. But
the headboard thing definitely seemed like that's just like a quick access thing. But I suppose it's also a hiding spot in that sense. So.
Right, but she probably has, I'm sure she has permits and stuff being a police officer, although
she's retired.
Although it's all hidden, no one's going to tell her no. I mean, obviously the DOPA is just kind of an Oklahoma thing based on Senator Keene and his work. But I suspect that the larger issue of guns is probably a Redford thing. And I imagine there was some attempt at a buyback program during his 8 terms or whatever.
Let's maybe start talking about Angela, who is played by Regina King and is our central character. I think Damon Lindelof has even said as much as that this series is her story.
Yes.
So
That seems apparent also. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like we're going to get some episodes here in the middle, which our previous episode kind of was told from Laurie Blake's point of view. I think the next episode may be Lady True, and the episode after that, Looking Glass. But I think...
And then obviously we get the Adrian interludes and stuff
that. Correct, yeah.
So Damon Lindelof has said that he was hugely influenced by watching Killing Eve and the idea of a female protagonist and antagonist, and that he's trying to set up Angela versus Agent Blake in the same kind of a way, which I think is really interesting.
Oh, okay.
That is interesting.
But they're obviously going to team up. I feel like that's telegraphed from the start, is having them team up against, whatever it's going to be, whether it's Adrian or Lady True.
Yeah, we'll, I mean, it certainly seems like that, but I guess maybe that's not correct, or maybe they will, sort of be on the same side, but never a team, and always sort of butting heads and trying to approach it differently. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Watchmen graphic novel sets up that you can have different solutions to the same problem and not then be on the same side as the other person seeking the same solutions, maybe. But it's interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes, the Angela and Lori relationship. Okay, so we meet Angela. She is, as we said, retired, quote unquote. She's left the police force as a uniformed patrol person, but she is now a masked vigilante in the guise of Sister Knight. We meet three or four. I think there are more, but we don't really meet them yet. But there are four, at least, that I can think of, masked vigilantes working for the Tulsa Police Department at this time. And Angela will be our central character. Go ahead.
I was going to say, is it almost more, we can certainly call them masked vigilantes, I suppose. But I almost felt it's more just when you're a detective and you get to wear plain clothes. But because everyone hides, then instead of plain clothes, they just wear a costume, right?
You get the cosplay.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm okay. I'm not, against calling them masked vigilantes exactly, but...
She has no restrictions on her weapons in the same way, right, that a uniformed officer does?
They're like the special police in the UK, right? They're actually allowed to access firearms.
I don't know at any given moment with her, I'm not sure whether she's acting correctly or not, I guess. Right? And I mean, very early on, Judd has the emergency order, whatever that was called, over Article Panda's 4, objections to allow the police to have weapons again. So, I mean, like, anything after that where she has a weapon is presumably authorized. I've only watched once, and so I don't have it clear in my head. I'm not sure what weapons she used before that authorization. That obviously could have been, you know, in the same way that she beat a location out of that guy in the warehouse. You know, that could have been not allowed or whatever.
I mean, she does it, like, outside of the raid on the 7th Cavalry farm and the one she has to protect her home, she doesn't use a gun at all so far.
Does she have guns at the bakery or not? I can't recall.
Oh.
I don't remember seeing one. I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
She has an armory there, but I don't think she's used them.
Yeah, but in general, she doesn't take them out unless she's expecting to go against other weapons.
Okay, so that sets up our when the 7th Cavalry member shoots the patrol officer in the first current scene, that kind of sets up the war between the 7th Cavalry, which is a white supremacist group who are inspired by the Journal of Rorschach, and who wear Rorschach masks, and they are responsible for an attack, which we alluded to, on Tulsa Police Force, I believe it's 3 or 4 years before the events of the current 2019?
Four or five,
something like that.
Not an incredibly large amount of time.
And as a result, the Special Defensive Police Act has been put in place, and then unknown restrictions, perhaps, like we've talked about gun control, which may or may not be tied to that, but or may just be a red Verde plot to steal our guns. But so that sets up what seems to be, on the surface, the major battle here in Tulsa between 7th Cavalry and the Tulsa Police. But quickly, with the introduction of, again, a Louis Gossett Jr. character, we get the notion that there might be a grander, more insidious conspiracy at work in the present day.
Yeah, and it's also still centered around Tulsa. I think the two major things are Tulsa is one of the few cities that experiences kind of the after effects of the Squid and having them all drop. And I think that the choice of Lady True to build the Millennium Clock in Tulsa is a very specific choice for reasons that have not been revealed yet.
I just want to make a trivial side comment that I love the word squid exploitation, and if there is any other reason to read PTpedia, that is the reason. Oh man, the PTpedia stuff is amazing. I can't believe I didn't read it till today. It's so good.
It really is.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem with the show, I think, but maybe we'll discuss that it's so important.
I'm of the opinion that it's fine.
I mean, I think it's fine for people that find it, but I don't.
It's kind of exactly my style of storytelling that I like.
Yeah, it's very. Well, it might be the most Watchmen thing about the Watchmen TV show, but I don't know that a TV show.
Already in with a singer.
Yeah.
As he would.
No, it's interesting that. Again, in the graphic novel, Adrian Veidt teleports a giant squid creature into New York City, killing 3 million people and leading to somewhat the end of the Cold War between the United States and the USSR. And apparently, in the present day, as Matt said, there are 4 cities, and one of them is referred to as Leningrad. So that would give us the notion that the Soviet Union still exists, having the Cold War ended prematurely.
It makes sense, right? You know, if one of the things that bankrupted the Soviet Union was keeping up in the arms race with the United States, maybe not having that help them stay on for longer, and maybe there were sort of some arms deals with the Soviet Union So I kind of like that as counterfactual.
Conserve resources a little better.
Mm.
Yeah, we definitely get that notion that Cold War ended through Adrian's conspiracy. And again, there's a conspiracy at the heart of this current world. It's interesting that the kind of the extreme right wing kooks are the ones that believe it's a conspiracy. And apparently the government on some level is covering up their knowledge of, I think they call it the dimensional invasion event or something like that. I forget what it's referred to in the PDpedia, but that in and of itself is interesting, that an insidious conspiracy is the heart of this very universe we're in, and then the tentacles, no pun intended, are spread out from that event that precipitated the current Watchmen series.
Rorschach's journal is like this like fringe. I mean, he was always kind of a weirdo, but it's like this fringe thing that absolutely no one believes. I mean, I guess I can buy that. But, I mean, because, like, what's that scene where the guy, he's talking about, he's like, they're wearing the Rorschach mask, we should look into that. And he's like, what is it, the 80s? No one cares about Rorschach anymore. So it seems like maybe there was, like, debate and controversy, and somehow the government or somebody just sort of settled it for everyone, and people moved on. That, yes. And the fact that apparently the lack of smartphones and internet and all of that is because they're afraid of technology. Because I guess the leading theory that came out was that we were too technologically advanced, and that's what led the squids to us. So, like, they basically, like, hit a rewind button and went back on technology.
And also the idea that Dr. Manhattan, he might be carcinogenic. So if all the technology, all the advances they had was based on his tech, that they need to dial that back. But there is a sign that it's now coming back to this world, like, slowly, a little bit. But, like, Battlestar Galactica, they're starting to network the computers again. And get
right,
email.
All the cars still run off of electric power that's like based off of Dr. Manhattan, right?
So yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah, and one thing might be worth saying, within the story, there's the American Hero story as a television show being shown in this universe. And we learned from the PDPedia stuff that the first season of American Hero story, which is apparently government propaganda, was based on Rorschach and was the government's attempt to kind of discredit Rorschach's journal.
Exactly. So there must have been enough people who believed there could have been a false flag operation to make the government want to do a kind of counterfactual history. So it can't just be the fringe.
So like squid blood doesn't
white supremacists who believe in it.
Steel beams.
Yeah.
Am I the only one that's kind of sad that like Rorschach was like co-opted, hijacked.
It really 100%. Bothered me. Yeah,
it's interesting because I think
what they want. They want it to be uncomfortable,
for sure.
Yeah, like it makes total sense. It still bothers me.
I mean, Rorschach is a bad guy, right? I mean, like, I'm not saying he's a Klansman or whatever, but like, so I mean, it doesn't bother me that he's hijacked. I mean, it bothers me a lot less that he's hijacked, just because, like, I mean, I love Rorschach; he's great, but like, he's a bad, very bad guy, right? I mean, it's not like
he does mean things, but he was the only one that was onto the truth and like wanted to like actually.
In that particular instance, yeah,
right.
Well, just generally, it's not like he has a untarnished reputation that we must preserve.
Well, he is a Rorschach, right? You see. In his character, bring your interpretation.
Like in general, not just the one fantasy.
Yeah, I think that's very much how Moore intended him to be. That you bring your biases and your comic book biases to the character, and what a character like that in real life might be underneath. And so I think the character, as we said, it's supposed to be uncomfortable for us that he's been adopted by these white supremacists, but on some level, he's an ambiguous character. I saw, I don't know, like a D&D alignment for Watchmen characters, and it's interesting to think where Rorschach would fit in there, and I think they had him as lawful neutral, which is...
Lawful neutral? That's interesting.
Which is okay. That kind of contradiction, right?
That's always hard. D&D alignments are fucking garbage. But I mean, like, I like them, but I mean, it's trying to map them onto real people is fucking stupid. But
well,
yeah,
he's not a real person. But yes,
mm-hmm. Right. Oh, yeah. All that makes sense. Yeah, no, it's entirely based on my love of the character as to why it bothers me. But it makes complete sense because that's the whole point of Rorschach, is that you put, you know, what you want to believe on his mask.
And maybe we should talk about Dr. Manhattan for a bit and his place so far in the story and where we think that might go.
Where is Dr. Manhattan?
So we get Mars. One scene where there's a, quote, live feed from Mars, Dr. Manhattan.
So we think he's still on Mars and that Laurie Blake's leaving him phone messages to Mars?
That's what we're led to believe.
Laurie Blake and a lot of other people, it seems like.
Do you think we're going to see him in this
series? They've set up a network. Yeah, I think they've said we will at some point.
I feel like we might have already, but we'll maybe go into
that. Right. Do you think so?
Really?
I like it.
Really?
I like it.
To that.
Who do you think it is?
Yeah, so if there's one character that I think might be Dr. Manhattan, I would say it's Topher Abar, their adopted son.
Oh, really?
I get a very. Well, I just every time I get a very uncomfortable vibe with him, and then we see Dr. Manhattan tearing down what appears to be Adrian Veidt's manor house or castle on Mars, and then we see Topher building it in kind of and Dr. Manhattan Legos in one scene, and I would keep an eye on him as a potential host for Dr. Manhattan. I don't know. That's just the vibe I get from that character so far. But I would just.
Well, I think they've made it. I think three different times they've made it clear that, like, well, Dr. Manhattan can't look like people. He's just blue. Like they've said that, and they're like, "Are you sure?"
People
you
know, have said so, that several times. Yeah.
Right. So I mean, it would make sense that someone with his powers could eventually evolve. And
I don't even think there's any eventually to it. Yeah, I mean, I think.
Can alter matter.
Dr. Manhattan could look like whatever he wants to. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, like, it's absurd that anyone thinks that he can't. I don't even understand their thought process behind, like, no, he can't do that. It has to be blue. Like, what are you talking about?
So someone said Damon Lindelof has said for sure we're going to see Dr. Manhattan, and it seems like in the previews for the rest of the season, we see a blue hand, I feel like, in a suit.
Yeah, obviously could so easily not be Dr. Manhattan, but it's a mean tease if it's not.
I think he'll play a major role no matter what. But, you know,
I mean, the existence of a god sort of has to, you know.
Yeah. Whether he physically exists to, like, do an action scene, who knows. But I think we'll get enough to be satisfied.
Yeah, so I wouldn't even... You're certain that he's on Mars other than we see, like I said,
right.
He destroys that castle, which seems like if it was like a government just telling people he's on Mars, then it wouldn't have that kind of specific detail to it. So
I think he's for sure on Mars, but he could be like 100 different places too, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know why he, like, if you're him, like, why would you ever abandon any project, right?
Well, at the end of the graphic novel, he says he's going to go off into the galaxy to kind
create
of experiment
life.
And create life. So it's interesting. We don't know here if he ever left our galaxy, or if, as Adam said, maybe he's in multiple places at the same time. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe all the characters are Dr. Manhattan.
That would be problematic.
It's just like Adrian with his clones. He's just putting on a little play.
He created Dr. Manhattan World.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Adrian for a bit. And whether they're clones or where he is, what he's up to.
Can we just talk about Jeremy Irons playing himself, literally? I mean, in everything Brideshead Revisited, I just feel that whenever he's in anything, he just plays this eccentric aristo English lord and just being insane and eccentric and just charismatic. And I mean, I could watch this guy just do anything. I relish the moments he's on screen. I don't even care where the plot goes. I just want to see him. I mean, the letter he typed or had typed for him.
Yeah.
the insults, the sheer bravado of it. I mean, this is the standout performance of the series. And I know that's going to piss off people who think it's Regina's, like, Angela Abar, that actress's, like, breakout moment. But it's all about Jeremy Irons for me.
I definitely am with you there. I mean, I mean, it's not like I'm bored by any scenes, but the Jeremy Irons ones are the ones that, like, when they cut to that manor house, it's like, oh yeah, I'm ready for this.
You definitely perk up, and he seems to be having fun with the character. Where do you guys think he is presently? What do you think his circumstances are? We learned in the third episode that he is in some form of captivity somewhere, and question of who is powerful enough to put Adrian Veidt in captivity is, I think, maybe limits our possibilities of what's going on, but it's super interesting whenever he's on screen.
He's catapulting someone outside of the atmosphere who comes back frozen cold, maybe suggests he's, you know, and the fact the ending of Watchmen, where that location is, and whether it's Manhattan or whether it's Lady True or someone who's holding him prisoner, I think those are the prevailing Reddit theories right now.
Yeah, so we're thinking Mars or Antarctica. Does anyone have any other?
Moon. I don't see how it could. Oh, I mean, I just feel like. Yeah, I feel like it's got to be somewhere. I don't know what the gravity is like on Mars. It's lower, is that right?
It's whatever Dr. Manhattan wants it to be.
Well, that's fair, I suppose. Well, I was just thinking, like, so, I mean, if he tosses his clones or whatever out of whatever protective bubble he's presumably in, and they freeze, fair enough, and then they fall back down, but the body did not seem to have been, like, completely, like, smashed apart the way that, I don't know. Right, it didn't seem to have taken a lot of damage aside from being frozen. Does that sound correct?
Sounds accurate. Yeah. So
like, I don't know if the gravity, if Earth, I mean, I don't know for sure how high the body went, but like, I mean, there doesn't seem to be much damage, and I might be reading too much into that. But
I think those are reasonable assumptions. So you think it's more likely Antarctica? Is that correct, or what do you think?
Me, I'm saying the opposite. I think it's
Mars.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Earth gravity is what I was saying. The body, aside from being frozen, the body does not seem to have taken a lot of falling damage. Right?
Right.
The body's relatively, like, it's not, the suit is not, the face mask is not broken, you know, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like the gravity would be lower. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, so I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it might be cracked, but it's certainly not destroyed in a way where you would think he went that high, or yeah, no, that's an interesting point of view. I guess I lean towards Antarctica, but maybe there's a third option that we're just not thinking of yet.
Antarctica seems like an odd choice. I mean, like, there's no reason to, because it seems like he's trying to do like some sort of air supply, right? I mean, like, you don't need an air supply in Antarctica. You just need to be bundled, right?
You also have to think about when he disappeared, though. Because, I mean, I think it says the last time he was seen in public was, like, 2007 or 2008. And, like, they didn't really start looking for him until, like, 2012. Like, they just assumed he was, you know, eccentric guy, would take off for long periods of time. So there was, like, if I don't think he was imprisoned immediately following, you know, the events of...
No, for sure he was not.
Dr. Manhattan could have waited if it's him. But if he'd waited so long, why? I don't know.
I think 2012 is when Lady True purchases. Is that correct? I don't remember the timeline perfectly either. When Lady True purchases Veidt Enterprises or whatever, and I don't recall when the last time he was seen publicly. But my guess is
I think it's around when they declare him dead.
I think he's just been declared dead in 2019. Is that true or not?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I feel like that's when the headline.
He was just being
Right.
So my guess is he's been in captivity since around 2012, and then each Jeremy Irons part of the program is another year, which seems to be, that's my guess again, with the, each episode has another candle on it. So I'm guessing, at least my guess is that Adrian's now 2015, 2016, somewhere in there, and that he will eventually escape, you know, somewhere around the 7th or 8th episode to be in our present timeline at the end. That's just my supposition.
It's a very Westworld timeline situation. Speaking of, you know, Westworld parallels.
Wouldn't surprise me in the least, though.
Yeah, no, wouldn't surprise me either. I think it sounds very plausible. But yeah, that the old, well, I guess in Westworld it was a young white guy who was on a different timeline than everyone else. But yeah.
So what about Mr. Phillips and Miss Crookshanks? I have some thoughts. I guess I was spoiled a little bit by going to IMDb to pull people's names and characters and stuff, but I'm interested what your thoughts on those two characters are. We think they're clones of some sort at this point. Clearly, they're not robots. They have organic material. So, yeah. Thoughts on those characters?
Also, pretty Westworld.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I guess I don't really have any thoughts. I don't know. I mean, they certainly do seem to be clones. Yeah, I have no idea. They seem to have no will, which is interesting. Also, I mean, like that's not. I mean, obviously, I was going to say that's not a side effect of cloning. I don't have any idea what the side effect of cloning would be. But yeah,
so
I'm certainly intrigued. Yeah.
For background, has anyone read, there's a current series called The Doomsday Clock by Jeff Johns from DC Comics. Has anyone read that? Or I'm curious.
No, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, so there, go ahead.
No, but I don't think the characters of Mime and Marionette are clones in that novel. Like, yeah, like I know.
No, they're definitely not, but Mime and Marionette, I believe, were cast.
Before, right, that's what they're listed yeah, as, but yeah. Like they're not. I feel like it might just be a nod to those characters. Over
yeah, there. I think we see that one scene again, and so I guess I should say Mime and Marionette are characters in the current Doomsday Clock series. The characters in Watchmen are based on Charlton Comics characters, without going into too much detail. And in Charlton Comics, Mime and Marionette are based on Punch and Julie. So these two characters are gonna appear in the series unless they're playing with us, which is possible with the casting. And by all appearances, those characters of Mime and Marionette, who it would be untrue to say they're like Joker and Harley Quinn, but that's maybe the best way to think about them without going into the characters too much. Appears that Crookshanks and Phillips are those characters, but again, that could be just a trick of casting, so I'm not sure. But there's one scene in the previews that looks, to me anyway, like it could be setting up Mime and Marionette's origin story.
Cool. I've just been Wikipediaing Charlton Comics. I'm kind of sad it doesn't exist, and I had no idea. And
oh, so Charlton Comics was a comic company like Marvel, DC, Shazam Comics, whatever, that DC eventually bought, I think, the early 80s.
Okay.
Originally, Alan Moore had the proposal for Watchmen, the comic series. He was going to use the Charlton characters, but when he got closer to production, the DC said, we're actually going to use these characters on our regular universe at some point. So then all of the characters, Rorschach, Night Owl, Silk Spectre, Dr. Manhattan, all those characters have equivalents in Charlton Comics, but then Moore kind of changed them all slightly for this Watchmen comic. The comedian, all those characters have their equivalents in the Charlton Comics originally. We want to talk about Judd, and I think maybe his wife.
Oh, I'm so sad that Judd is a KKK guy.
Well, is he? We don't.
Isn't that implied by the PTpedia thing? Like the idea that he inherits the
for
painting?
Sure,
his like secret father organization.
For sure his father was a KKK again.
I mean, if he wasn't, wouldn't he get rid of that Comanche Feats of Outstanding Miraculous Horsemanship painting? Given,
I don't know.
It might be one of those things because, you know, good memories of your father. It might be hard to let go, even though you think it's like a terrible thing. Yeah, I don't know. Like, if I was in that situation, what would I do? I'd probably burn the thing, but who knows?
I don't know how you would kind of rectify if he's not a racist. And it seems like he has general affection for Angela and Cal and their family. But there also definitely are some unanswered questions about the White Knight and about Judd's character. And then Judd, as we kind of talked about, Judd and his wife are kind of tied to the Keane family. Current Watchmen series would be Senator Joe Keane Jr. His father was responsible for the Keane Act in 1977, which outlawed costume vigilantes. And we learn through the Pedipedia material that his father and Judd's father were members of the Ku Klux Klan. And it's unclear, I guess, then, if Judd, what Judd's relationship. Judd's obviously has stuff to hide. I think him doing coke in the first episode is going to have meaning.
Yeah, I agree.
I think him, that phone call where he tells his wife that the police officer who's been shot has woken up, doesn't feel like he's telling her the truth. The way he dresses in his uniform in that scene feels to me like he's dressing for his own, I don't know. I feel like he knows his fate at that point. So I'm interested to see. I don't know how they could trace that phone call or if that'll ever come up, but I think that I don't know what I think. What do you guys think about Judd and some of the questions surrounding his character and where that might lead us?
I think if there is, as Louis Gossett Jr. says, a vast and insidious conspiracy, I think Senator Keene and Judd would probably be involved in that. And it's probably something that they inherited through their legacies, and we'll find out eventually.
So in comics, the notion of legacy is pretty important. Passing from like Night Owl 1 to Night Owl 2, or Silk Spectre 1 to Silk Spectre 2, or in the case of May Jo Keene, Lori Blake becoming her taking on the legacy of both her father, the comedian, and her mother, the Silk Spectre, and then choosing the name Blake and choosing a very kind of nihilistic, so far from what we've seen, kind of working for the government kind of life that's very close to what her father ended up doing, I think is an important legacy that we're seeing in the show as well. Do we want to talk about Louis Gossett Jr. and, I guess, his legacy being Angela in part, and where we think his character is, who came and took him out of the sky?
I just have no idea what's going on.
I also have very little interest. To my shame, right? I should be. His is the opening story of this season. I find myself bizarrely not caring. There are other mysteries that are far more tantalizing to me than that. So I'll go with it when it reveals itself, but I don't have anything particularly interesting to say.
I am much more in the position of I would like to know what's going on rather than I feel like I do know what's going on. It's definitely one of those things where doing like a mid-season or a third of the way through review makes it hard to talk about some stuff because I really don't know.
Yeah, see, I want to get us all on the record so we're all
ready. Oh no, I try to avoid that if at all possible. I'll just claim later on that I knew all along.
Yeah, so like the car that falls at the end of episode 3 is like imply that like that's Dr. Manhattan's reply, cuz you see kind of like the Mars sort of like lights up. But
certainly
then like
implied.
Is that just the car that took him the episode before? Like yes. What, you know?
It is.
It's
Angela's minivan or whatever for sure.
It's the same car. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought, but
at the same time, anyone...
What does it all mean? I don't know.
Yeah, anyone capable of taking the car in the first place... I mean, I don't know why Mars winked red at that moment, right? I mean, like, that's odd. Part of the reason why, it implicated Dr. Manhattan was that it was right after she came out of the Dr. Manhattan phone booth. But anyone could have seen that, right? I mean, like, they see where she is. I mean, obviously she's talking to Dr. Manhattan, and they could decide to drop the car right after she did that, right? I mean, so like that's not hard to fake, I suppose, in that way. But yeah, I don't know. I had another question actually I only read, and I don't know that it would be there anyway, but I only read the Pedipedia after the first episode, so I haven't read all of it. Did the Tulsa police have the actual Night Owls Archimedes, or was that just some other,
I don't know.
Has that technology been
duplicated? I don't think that's revealed in the Pedipedia.
Okay. Does anyone have any thoughts on that? Whether they somehow got Night Owl's actual stuff and why?
Why the hell would
that
be in Tulsa?
Yeah. Why would that happen?
Unless they were arrested in Tulsa.
Yeah.
No, they're replicas.
You think so? So if they're replicas, and that's perfectly fair. But if they're replicas, then I sort of don't know why we haven't seen more like flying craft. I mean, like obviously, whatever took the car seemed like the same sort of thing. Yeah. I guess so maybe it took,
like, the 7th Cavalry has, like, a Cessna 152. So,
sure, yeah, exactly.
I think it's most likely that they do. I mean, my thoughts would be that Judd might have been Night Owl, just because he is, like, an owl mug. He is under a hood on his desk, but it's clear that he is not or was not. So I don't know exactly. I think it was marked with police markings and stuff, but it is weird that that's the only one we've seen. And it's clear that when Angela's car is taken with Louis Gossett Jr., it's taken technologically, right, with like a giant electromagnet attached to the bottom of something. But when it's returned, it's less clear to me whether that's... you would think the same person would return it that took it, but it also the timing of her joke to Dr. Manhattan and the winking of Mars seems to...
Certainly seems to. Yeah. Sorry, because I'm the nitpick person. But also, I'd like to say from the first episode, grabbing the control wheel from somebody to try to target something is just about the dumbest thing
I thought that whole raid was really a shit show.
The raid was definitely a shit show, but the fact that that worked, he's like, no, just yank up really hard. That'll get your target lock. Like, what are you doing?
I mean, like, she's going in there with a sidearm, and you have to believe that you don't know for sure they have a 50 caliber machine gun, but you have to believe those people are heavily armed. And
they went in there,
It was.
What's the population of Tulsa in this world? Do we know?
I would assume larger than ours.
What's the population of ours?
It's not. It's pretty small, right? It's like
I bet
half
it's,
million at the most.
Yeah, I was gonna say if I were gonna bet, I would bet in the 500,000 range.
Wikipedia says 401,800 people in 2017.
Yeah, I feel good then.
So it's like a sizable American city, if not a major American city, whose police force was completely decimated in like one night. So I would imagine, especially with like Keene Jr. passing the law to let them, you know, wear masks and stuff, I bet a whole bunch of funding came with that. I bet those police are paid very well. Maybe they got some Night Owl ships, you know, like that may be why they have all this like kind of crazy tech for such a small city.
Yeah, so I think red fredations, so if you could prove that you are a descendant of someone involved in the Tulsa massacre, then you could come and live in Tulsa, I think, tax-free. So I think there's a larger, more vibrant African-American community because businesses and trying to rebuild the green.
I want to point out the genius of having Johnny Cochran be the lawyer who pushes for red fedations. For any of us who watch the OJ trial, that kind of grandstanding, highly race-conscious kind of diatribes he used to deliver, I think that it's just beautiful, beautiful fake history.
Yeah, no, all the fake history with Johnny Cochran, with John Grisham being on the Supreme Court, with Dr. Oz being the Surgeon General, like, it's hilariously brilliant.
That's my favorite.
Johnny Cochran did, in our real life, I believe, file reparations lawsuits on our Earth. Okay, other mysteries Bina mentioned. What other mysteries interest you, Bina?
Like, status of Dr. Manhattan, who or where he is, the whole Adrian fight, who or where he is, Lady True, inter alia. Just whether we're going to find out whether Judd was or was not, in fact, a racist. Like, pretty much everything else in the show is more interesting to me than this particular story, which I hate, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, so Lady True should definitely, I think, we'll get a lot of illumination on Lady True's character, or at least I'm sure we'll get more questions than answers, but we'll at least get some things to hang our thoughts on this next episode with Lady True.
Yeah, we can definitely discuss her later. I think basically my interest in the Louis Gossett Jr. character is based on the prevailing theory that he may be Hooded Justice, and that, you know, perhaps him and the people who whisked him away, are, you know, part of an underground group that is, you know, linked to our previous mass vigilantes that we know from the comics. I mean, when he gets whisked away by that car, you know, my first thought is immediately that it's Archie. And so it's just whether or not that kind of, you know, there's an underground group of people, you know, tangentially or directly related to kind of the previous Minutemen or mass vigilantes and Night Owl and Hooded Justice and all that, that could be fascinating in the end.
Yeah, that seems to be where they're going, or at least the implication that Will Reeves is, or was, I guess is, Hooded Justice. I guess he retired in 1965 either way. Who would be left from the previous story to be operating Archie, or what masked vigilantes do we know?
Yeah, anyone?
New generation or something? Or?
Yeah, I guess yeah. I guess so. So if there were any kids, they would be 30 plus years. So it might be kids or just people we've never seen before.
Yeah. Right, just co-workers. That's a thing where it's just the Night Owl and Laurie as the comedian, you know, were still in the vigilante game until their capture in 1995. And so there could be still, you know, some leftover.
I guess so, yeah, because she's part of a mass vigilante task force, so there must be people operating.
Oh yeah, they're definitely still vigilantes that operate that.
Yeah. We're not
that they're being tracked down. With. Right, correct. They're just, you know, mentioned hand.
Yeah, and I feel like if this gets like where they were probably doing it for, you know, what, you know, 10 years or whatever before they kind of went out and they were like the big names, they probably had other people that kind of spawned and took that up. But once they got taken down, maybe more people went underground, like, cuz if you still have the you know, impulse to be a, you know, a vigilante in that way, maybe you don't like wear a same costume every time, maybe you keep more to the shadows, you know. Maybe you're not like the dude in the bank robbery.
Mr. Shadow, you're referring to? Or is it Dr. Shadow or Mr. Shadow?
Yeah, something like that.
She says she's like, I'm here to protect, you know, protect America from like rich assholes playing dress up or something.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I know Lindelof did this on purpose, but like, I want to see the story of how she went from, you know, she was a government superhero with Dr. Manhattan, kind of one of the last ones left, and then her and, you know, Night Owl had their years. She was obviously very much into that life to now where she's just like, they're all terrible. But like, it does seem that she, you know, she'd want to free, you know, Night Owl if she could. So I'm curious, like, that character's journey is very interesting. We're not going to get to see it, unfortunately, which, you know, I think is the point. Like, we're all just left to wonder how she got there.
Well, I think that we'll definitely get some of that filled in, if not all of it. But mean, she seems to accept Keane's sending her to Oklahoma on the promise of getting Dan released from prison. It appears like she's cut a deal and Dan refuses to cut a deal. But
that
again,
seems like the most reasonable situation. Yeah.
Maybe she named some names and it says he hasn't said shit about shit. So
yeah. So who in this world is aware for sure that Veidt sent the squid? Do we know? Is it just Dan and Lori?
And probably True.
And we think True, maybe, yeah. Because she has her own, it seems like, anyway, like Adrian plan to save humanity.
Yeah, and Adrian, you know, Adrian disappeared right around the time that she bought the company. So those two events are almost guaranteed to be linked.
So
that's the smartest man in the world. How could that happen?
Yeah, I can't wait to find out who the game warden is for sure.
You know, reconvening after episode 6 is probably
that'll make a good
option. Just from what I've heard with reviews, you know, like next episode is True, then 5 is Looking Glass, and then episode 6 is just supposed to be some, like, you know, just crazy shit. So that seems to be the best time to reconvene, and I'm definitely excited for that going forward. I just wanted to kind of like highlight some of the other stuff that I really liked about this show that I don't think we've touched on yet. I mean, we can definitely save Looking Glass for another time just because we haven't gotten enough of his character yet. But I'm definitely very excited to see where that goes. But just, you know, I just want to heap more praise on Regina King as Sister Knight. And like, she's such a good actress in everything she does. Like, I'm so excited to kind of see her in this role, and just like the general design of her costume, as well as Looking Glass and Red Scare, is just, is just incredible, and kind of those, you know, small details I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, where everything they've done of the design choices and all the little like callbacks and nods we see to the lore and all that, whether it be, you know, a replica of Archie and Night Owl's glasses, you know, there's lines here and there, the Laurie Blake telling the joke, you know, in the style of Rorschach did. There was that fun little sign in the first episode that said the future is bright.
Yeah.
As a reference to Rorschach's The End Is Nigh.
Yeah. So is that guy, I tried on rewatch to see if that guy is anywhere else, but I
not that I noticed.
Yeah. I have not noticed him return. I kind of was thinking he was going to be at the funeral and everywhere, but, as you say in the graphic novel, Rorschach is first set up as a End Is Nigh sign carrying guy before we realized that that's who he is. So I was trying to figure out if that guy is going to be someone later on, but I haven't seen him again.
I think it was just a shout out. And yeah, and then everything Louis Gossett Jr.'s done, kind of with, you know, the namely being, you know, why he's probably, you know, he might be Hooded Justice is basically the red coat, and kind of like the design of the clothing he's wearing is very reminiscent of Hooded Justice's costume. That fun little thing, like, do you think I could lift 200 pounds? Like, that was the first, you know, line he said to Angela. That's fun. So that
seems to imply that he has some future knowledge, correct?
No, I just thought that, you know, it's within his plan.
Yeah, but I think he's referring to hanging Judd from that tree, right, as the 200 pounds. So,
I assume.
Right, so it was just something he was planning, not necessarily knowledge of the future.
Oh, so you think he is involved in the murder of Judd?
I mean, what's the alternative, that he spotted him hanging from the tree and decided to fuck with Angela?
Well, that he has, through Dr. Manhattan, he has knowledge that Judd's going to end up dead and he's going to hang him from a tree. I took it to mean that he has temporal knowledge that we do not.
Oh wow.
No, I thought he was involved just because.
Yeah, I don't think.
Because he knew of Judd's background, or of his family's background, at least.
I mean, I guess, I mean, maybe that makes sense. I mean, like, he's certainly, it's not a very nice thing to do, to associate yourself in somebody's mind with the murder of a mentor of theirs. But I mean.
Yeah, I don't believe he had anything to do with Judd's murder.
Okay.
Myself, mm-hmm. I don't know. But, I don't know. I mean, the implication of Bass Reeves taking out the crooked sheriff, the sheriff and the silent film from the first episode. I don't know. I don't think he actually had anything to do.
Okay.
With,
all right.
But
I mean, that maybe that makes sense. I guess I don't know. It is odd. I mean, I guess gods can do what they want to do. It's a little bit odd that, I mean, like, why bother having minions if you're Dr. Manhattan? But I guess, you know, gods are gods.
Yeah, I don't think Hooded Justice and Manhattan would have, or John Osterman would have ever had reason to know each other before becoming, or after even. I don't know. Theoretically, in the comic, Hooded Justice dies in like 1955, right, or something, and Osterman becomes Manhattan in 1959 or something like that. I might have the dates wrong, mm-hmm. but I don't think they have any connective tissue. My feeling just from watching it is that Louis Gossett Jr. on some level is working with Dr. Manhattan, and I can't prove it.
Oh, really?
That's just my feeling, yeah.
Well, I mean, yes. If he had, as you're saying, I mean, if he had some sort of future knowledge, then, I mean, he would almost have to be, unless they're introducing some other character with foresight. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think it's the kind of thing that will make me, it's the kind of thing that might make me mad at the show, because it just seems like, why, like, unnecessarily complicated it for Dr. Manhattan to be like, well, no, obviously I can split myself into many copies and look like whatever I want to look like, but I'm going to use you as a minion to go out and, you know, do all this stuff. I don't know. Right. Well, like, why would he have...
Dr. Manhattan and the comedian worked together, you know, like, I guess, worked together for the U.S. government at times, like in Vietnam and stuff. I don't...
I mean, that's true. That's fair.
Do you need the comedian to do anything?
No.
I mean, he's just a guy with a gun have Dr. Yeah. Manhattan.
Oh, but apparently. Well, I think maybe there were things that Dr. Manhattan wouldn't do.
Would not do, the comedian certainly would. Yeah. I thought of that after I started talking, but it undermined my point, so I ignored it.
Yeah, I think if Dr. Manhattan's involved, he's kind of his own thing, and that if people are quote-unquote working with him, they don't know it. I just think like he's an own entity inside unto himself.
Well, he says he has friends in high places, and...
He certainly ties himself to Dr. Manhattan in various ways.
That's true.
But I don't know what Dr. Manhattan has to gain from the association. Or, like, as Thomas was saying, I don't know how they would have necessarily gotten to know each other either. But I mean, maybe he used to use this phone booth a lot or something.
Yeah, I mean, if Topher, I believe Topher's involved with Dr. Manhattan, or actually is Dr. Manhattan or something, I don't know. So, and Angela is his granddaughter. I think there will be connections between Louis Gossett Jr. What is this for? Will Reeves and... Dr. Manhattan before this is through. But yeah, again, I mean, it was technology that grabbed it. Like, if it was like a beam of, you know, but it was an actual electromagnet that grabbed that car.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, people have said that like Will, like he just says things that like, it seems cryptic and like, you know, but it, a lot of like the weird cryptic stuff he says just ends up being very literal. So
yeah,
I don't know.
And he seems to have, we don't know what those pills are actually for, but he seems to have like some cognitive issues. I mean, at 105 or something. So
I mean, maybe he is Dr. Manhattan.
I mean, there are.
And that would solve my objection to why would Dr. Manhattan have minions, right? Like, well, he wouldn't. He'd just go himself.
I don't know. God has angels or something, right? I mean, I'm not saying literally, but
just lazy. No, for sure.
Yeah.
There are also, you know, in the lore of Watchmen, there are psychics. So like that, you know, they could bring those up, but they haven't really introduced that idea yet. But it is a slight possibility.
It's tangential. So you should definitely go back to the answer.
Well, mine is like, tangential too, but
okay. Well, I was going to say, so in the, I don't remember the graphic novel as well as I should. In the movie, Adrian catches a bullet with his hand.
Yes.
Right? Does that happen in the comic book as well?
Yeah.
Yes.
So okay. He's been training to do that.
Well, I mean, his whole life. I mean, it's still a superpower, but I mean, I don't care how.
Well, it's not in the graphic novel. It's not a super. It's something he's trained.
It's great reflex and Kevlar gloves, right?
Sorry, it's a superpower in as much as you know, like. Like Batman is a superhero,
it's
right?
Super, I mean, it's superhuman.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure.
Sorry, I didn't mean it was a superpower. Like he was like an ability he inherited or whatever.
Yeah.
So when Adrian is riding his horse through the manor or grounds or whatever, there's that pirate flag.
Yeah.
The Black Freighter flag, and right. Mm-hmm. Why in the world?
My
is
theory
that
is
there?
That Pirate Jenny put that there. It's pirate Jenny.
So I mean, so I don't know why it's that. Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say the name of the motel.
What's the motel?
The motel Black Freighter Inn or something.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's where he's staying at.
Yeah.
So the flag itself, just as if you ignore the Black Freighter thing, the flag is, I think, is clearly to mark the boundary of where Vite is not allowed to go.
Right.
Why they would use the flag of a Black Freighter other than just as a reference, I don't know.
Yeah, so I'm writer kind of the Black Freighter comic is also one of the people that Adrian has work on the squid plot, I think. So yeah, I'm thinking maybe maybe that's all tied together. The black, like, somehow those people, I think they were all killed, but somehow...
Yeah, they're dead.
Age Shrew is using... I don't know, but it seems to me a weird boundary marker to have that specific thing if those people or that writer wasn't somehow involved in his present captivity in some way I'm not fully able to explain.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible that some stuff is just... Like, I mean, in the same way that, like, I don't think that the name of the motel is probably not relevant. It's just an Easter egg. So, I mean, it's certainly... possible that the boundary sign is just supposed to be a boundary sign, and the fact
like
that
you're dead, I guess, like Skull won't if you go
right,
past
yeah, okay. Right, like Skull and Crossbones on a bottle of poison or something.
Yeah,
yeah, no, I saw it as an Easter egg as well.
Okay, I did it first too, and then I'm like, is there a deeper meaning there? But maybe there's just
not. Yeah, I mean, it could go either way, certainly. Yeah,
that's all I got. But if Sister Knight and Lori like don't go on a mission and Archie together later on, I'll be disappointed.
Seems they're together, right, with Lady True in the next episode where she's kind of explaining her evil plot, her great plot, however you want to look at it. But so it'll be interesting. I like them more as antagonists, I guess, than teaming up at this point. But I've not seen Lady Eve too much to know enough to know what that might imply.
Yeah, I am somewhat assuming that Lady True is going to end up being the main antagonist of the season.
That's kind of where I'm at right now as well, but we should get some clarity at least shortly. Thanks again, and hopefully we'll be back after 6. Sounds like the plan at this point.
You know, I think the next episode's going to be a big one, and I can't wait to reconvene and see if our ideas are on the right track, but that's pretty much it from me for now, I think.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Thomas.